Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Bella, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop. And today's workshop is being has a partner organization called Share Cancer Support, and you'll be hearing more about the resources that they offer you as well. Now, today's program is supported by Pfizer and made possible through an educational independent grant from Merck and Company, Inc. And I'd like to really thank them for their support of today's program. And again, this activity is supported by Pfizer and made possible through independent grant from Merck and Company, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of this program. Now, before I introduce our first speaker, I'd like to let you know about who is on the call today. We have over 152 participants, and you come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Saudi Arabia, the Philippines, Uganda, and the United Kingdom. And it's really a credit to all of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us, to learn more about advances in the treatment of cervical cancer. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Carolyn Runowitz. And Dr. Runowitz is Professor Emerita, Obstetrics and Gynecology, Herbert Wertheim College of Medicine, Florida International University. And Dr. Runowitz will be addressing an overview of cervical cancer, including diagnosis and staging, and combination treatments. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Runowitz.
Thank you, and thank you for including me in this teleconference. I am honored to participate with my esteemed colleagues. I have no conflicts to declare. Cancer of the uterine cervix is the third most common gynecologic cancer in the United States. The global incidence varies based on the presence of screening programs and HPV, human papillomavirus, vaccination. Human papillomavirus is central to the development of cervical neoplasia and can be detected in almost 100% of cervical cancers. The diagnosis of cervical cancer is made by pathologic examination of a cervical biopsy. The pathologist is essential in this evaluation and determining the type of cervical cancer. The most common histologic types of cervical cancer are squamous cell and followed by adenocarcinoma. The incidence of invasive cervical adenocarcinoma and its variants have increased dramatically over the past few decades, particularly in younger patients. Dr. Kerr will discuss this in more detail and also discuss some of the markers that we need based on the biopsy. In 2018, FIGO, which is the International Federation of Gynecology and Obstetrics, updated the staging for cervical cancer. When you are diagnosed with cervical cancer, you are given a stage. And this new staging included now a three size range criteria for stage 1B and a new stage 3C. Based on 2018 staging may now include a number of imaging studies, including computed tomography or CAT scan, magnetic resonance imaging or MRI, and positron emission tomography or PET scans. Pathological findings and includes pathologic or radiographic assessment of the lymph nodes. So the staging really was very important, these changes in 2018. Since treatments vary from simple to radical surgery with or without chemotherapy, it is very important that patients seek an opinion from a gynecologic oncologist, radiation oncologist, and ideally have input from a tumor board, which includes a pathologist, a medical oncologist, and others to determine the best course of treatment. And how that is done is where you get your biopsy, that team will present your results to this conference. So it's important to ask about that. Surgery can allow preservation of the ovaries in women less than 50 years of age with oocyte, with egg retrieval, for future in vitro fertilization and surrogacy. So as compared to past decades, women who are treated with cervical cancer, if they avail themselves of these options, can have a baby in the future. Radical trachelectomy, which is a radical removal of the cervix, upper vagina, and tissue next to the cervix called the parametria, and a cerclage or a suture is placed around the cervix, and minimally invasive surgery for the lymphadenectomy, may be an option in selected patients who wish to preserve fertility. This option is best exercised with a gynecologic oncologist. For low risk, surgery for stages 1B and 1B2, that is less than 4 centimeter cancers, an open radical hysterectomy with lymph node dissection by a gynecologic oncologist who is a physician specially trained in these surgical procedures. A less radical procedure can be performed in stage 1A2 and selected stage 1B patients. And again, those options are discussed with the gynecologic oncologist. Radiation therapy is also an option depending on the medical condition of the patient, the stage, and histopathology. In patients who are intermediate risk or high risk, and that is dependent on the pathology and the staging, chemotherapy is combined with radiation with a platinum-based regimen, either as a single agent or in combination. However, induction therapy, that is with a platinum-based therapy prior to radiation, may also be considered, and the radiation follows that induction chemotherapy. Incorporation of immunotherapy with or without bevacizumab for advanced stage disease is associated with a survival benefit, and I think we'll hear more about this from Dr. Einstein. After treatment is finished, it's important that you stay with your physicians for post-treatment surveillance, which includes physical exams, imaging, and if there's any concern, biopsy as indicated. If the disease does come back, it can come back locally or it can come back in other places in your body. For locally recurring disease, usually the presenting symptom is bleeding or discharge, and the treatment may involve radiation therapy or surgery. This is best decided in consultation with a gynecologic oncologist and radiation oncologist to determine the best plan of treatment. It is also important to consider a clinical trial in certain circumstances. Antibody drug conjugates may be an option for patients with disease progression after treatment with chemotherapy and immunotherapy. New therapies for metastatic and recurrent disease will be discussed by Dr. Einstein. These therapies may include bevacizumab, chemotherapy, immunotherapy, antibody drug conjugates, and other new and novel therapies. Enrolling in a clinical trial is very important. For patients with advanced or recurrent cervical cancer, I cannot overemphasize the importance of clinical trials. Clinical trials are research studies that involve, in our case, female patients. Anytime you or a loved one need treatment for cancer, clinical trials should be a viable option. You can go online and search for clinical trials nearest you. Their website is www.cancerclinicaltrials.gov, and this website is posted on the Cancer Care website. CancerCare also can provide assistance in your search for clinical trials. Thank you for your attention. I will now turn the program back to Dr.
Don't Metzger. Put it in the bedroom. Hi, thank you so much, Dr. Ronowitz. That was just a superb presentation, and just a wonderful presentation, I have to say. And you really set the stage for today's program as the first speaker. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so just a stellar presentation. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Mark Einstein, and Dr. Einstein is Chair, Obstetrics and Gynecology and Women's Health, Montefiore Medical Center, Professor and the Chella and Moisa Safra Endowed Chair of Obstetrics and Gynecology in Women's Health, Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And Dr. Einstein will be addressing how precision medicine and testing inform your treatment decisions, sequencing of treatments, new and emerging treatment approaches, updates on clinical trials. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Einstein.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and thank you, Dr. Ronowitz, for a wonderful opening introduction. Before I really get into some of the testing, I do want to talk about the prevention aspects of cervical cancer. I know that, and I want to thank all of the audience. We have people that are undergoing therapy right now. I know we have people that are in families that are undergoing therapy. We have survivors, and I thank you all so much for educating not only yourselves but also others with regards to how we can treat cervical cancer. But as you know, the great American Ben Franklin once said, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And when it comes to precision medicine and testing, we've had a number of dramatic changes in how we prevent cervix cancer. Many of you are familiar with the Pap test. Many of you have had a Pap test in the past, and Pap has done a wonderful job in decreasing the incidence of cervical cancer in much of the world. But we could do better. We now have, Dr. Ronowitz mentioned this silly but very common virus called human papillomavirus, which is very ubiquitous, but it also is a virus that could be used from an individualized standpoint to precisely and with high sensitivity figure out whether or not someone's at risk, not just today, but in the future, of getting precancer or cancer. And we screen people to really identify the precancer so we could catch it before it becomes cancer. But now we're using not just a broader HPV testing that had, you know, about 13 different HPV types, but we now have what we call extended genotyping, where we look for three different groups of types, one a very, very high-risk group, one sort of an intermediate-risk group, and one sort of a lower but high-risk yet nonetheless group. And the benefits of this is we could really triage patients that might be the highest risk quicker to the next steps of diagnosis and the next steps of treatment while safely watching and doing surveillance on individuals that might not need these procedures right away. So the precision medicine not only helps us to find, shall we say, the smaller needle in the haystack, but it helps us to really identify those patients that don't need potentially unnecessary procedures. And this has really been helpful. And the nice thing about HPV testing, it is also amenable to what we call self-sampling, where it's really we put a dry swab in the vagina, something that can be done in an office setting. And right now we're doing a large clinical trial with the National Cancer Institute called the Last Mile Initiative, where we could actually do this at home too. So imagine a time where you don't even have to come to the doctor's office to get cervical cancer screening. So, and this is a very precise and highly sensitive way to do this. So potentially even getting right to where we need treatment just from the molecular testing that's done from a swab that's put in the vagina at home or in a bathroom, even in a non-traditional office setting. So this will hopefully open up access, and I, you know, as myself, and I know Dr. Ronowitz, you know, as GYN oncologist, I look forward to the day when I never have to see another patient suffer from cervical cancer again. So it is my hope that we will, that this will continue to broaden the access, not just in the United States, but globally as well. I wanted to continue with some of the stuff that Dr. Ronowitz had spoken about earlier, which is precision medicine and some of these targeted therapies that are out there right now. So for early stage cancer, typically the treatment, as Dr. Ronowitz mentioned, is these sort of radical procedures. But even from the tissue that we get either do a radical procedure or even just from a biopsy when it might not be a surgically amenable tool, we can do testing on this tumor, all right? One of the most common tests that we do is something called looking for a specific protein called programmed death ligand 1 or PDL1, okay? This is a laboratory test that we could do even from a small biopsy. And this tells us whether or not the tumor is amenable to one of the novel therapies that was mentioned before. This is immunotherapy, okay? And we know that immunotherapy, adding immunotherapy not only after primary treatment but during primary treatment can actually improve overall survival. And that's something we always want to do is continue to strive to improve survival. For what we call locally advanced cervical cancer, in terms of the sequencing of the treatments, if we know that the tumor does express this PD-1 and the patient is locally advanced, typically the mainstay of treatment is what we call radiation therapy. In fact, the field of radiation oncology got its start from cervical cancer, where oftentimes these tumors just melt away with radiation. But when we also know that adding a little bit of chemotherapy, as Dr. Ronowitz had mentioned, it actually makes the cells much more radiosensitive, okay? So it makes these cells more amenable to the radiation treatment. And not like 1 plus 1 equals 2, but 1 plus 1 equals 4. They're far, far more sensitive to radiation. And in addition to using chemo, we'll use immunotherapy during radiation therapy. And this was a recent clinical trial that came out called KEYNOTE-A18. This really literally just came out a few months ago, that showed that if we could actually give immunotherapy during the upfront therapy with radiation and a little touch of chemotherapy, we could improve overall survival even more. So this is a dramatic improvement and a very different paradigm from what we've done in the past with locally advanced cervical cancer. In addition to testing for PD-1, we could sometimes do this thing called next-generation sequencing, which is a technology that really sequences large amounts of genetic material, and it tells us what are the genes that might be running this tumor. And while this might not help in the upfront setting, it certainly can help if the tumor does recur or if it comes back, and it kind of guides us to some even more targeted therapies that are mostly in clinical trials right now. One of the newest types of drugs that we use for cancer care is something called an antibody drug conjugate. All right, this is a type of cancer treatment that combines what we call a monoclonal antibody. So this is sort of the lock and key of the immune system with the cytotoxic drug. Okay, and in fact, one of the first antibody drug conjugates in the treatment of cervical cancer is a drug called Tivtak, which has come out. And it actually works quite well in the recurrent setting of cervical cancer. And these are very, very targeted, specific targets on the cancer cells, okay, and potentially highly cancer-killing while sparing normal cells, all right? In addition, there's a whole host of these antibody-drug conjugates that are coming out that are in clinical trials. And the main reason is to go from knowing the target to making one of these drugs, and, you know, I'm not a drug manufacturer, but apparently the steps are much quicker, all right? So we could get these drugs to the patients, you know, who need them the most, the quickest. And so we're obviously very thrilled about that, all right? We just have to test to make sure in clinical trials if these drugs are working. In addition to ADCs or antibody drug conjugates, there's a number of other targeted therapies that appear to have some efficacy, at least in early stage clinical trials, including RET or RET inhibitors and NTRK inhibitors. These are showing some significant targeted, they target specific genetic mutations or proteins, and this can really, really help in the future. All right. And with more clinical trials, we can determine at what stage and what types of cancer that we could target those therapies. And we could do it in a way that will spare the normal tissues far better than we could do 20 years ago. So these are very hopeful trials and very hopeful agents that we could use, and these are the emergent treatment approaches that we look forward to continuing to study in the near future so that we could get cures to our patients quicker. I'll hand it back on to Dr. Mester.
Einstein, that was just a superb, stellar presentation. lots of information for our participants. I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Dr. Sarah Kerr, and Dr. Kerr is Chair, Department of Pathology, Abbott Northwestern Hospital, pathologist specializing in molecular genetic pathology, gynecologic and perinatal pathology, pulmonary pathology, and cytopathology. Hospital Pathology Associates and Alena Health, Minneapolis, Minnesota. And Dr. Kerr will be addressing the role of the pathologist, biomarker and diagnostic technologies, and how research increases treatment options. It's my pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Kerr.
Thank you so much. Hello, everyone. Thanks so much for the opportunity to speak on this conference today. It's my great pleasure to introduce you to the role of pathology in the care of patients with cervical cancer. So first off, I'm a pathologist. What does that mean? A pathologist is a doctor who goes to medical school with the rest of your doctors initially and then specializes in laboratory testing. So with cervical cancer, I as a pathologist am involved in reading those PAP tests that Dr. Einstein talked about. I oversee human papillomavirus testing in the laboratory and also make the diagnosis on tissue biopsies, so cervical biopsies, LEAP cones, hysterectomy specimens, and other patient specimens. A pathologist has a huge laboratory team that helps process these specimens and evaluate all of these different types of specimens for cervical cancer for screening or to make the diagnosis so that your oncologist has all of the information to help you with treatment decision making. So just exactly how do those pap smears and biopsies and surgery specimens get from a patient to a pathologist for all of the tests that are needed? Cervical cancer patients will sometimes have an abnormal pap test, which is obtained by brushing or scraping of the cervix to look for cancer cells or precancer cells under a microscope. And then that same material is used also for that HPV testing. Other patients might present with bleeding from the vagina caused by a cancer or have something abnormal seen during a routine pelvic exam. And once the cancer is suspected, then the patient will usually have a biopsy, which can be guided by something called colposcopy, which uses special solutions to look for lesions with a special light. And then LEAP conization, which stands for loop electrosurgical procedure, or sometimes a cold knife cone with a knife is taken to take out a portion of the cervix to make a definitive diagnosis. And it's really important to measure exactly how big that tumor is, how deep it's invaded into the cervix. So only a pathologist can really tell for sure by looking at that tissue under a microscope, and for small tumors, actually measuring with a ruler or a special device that we use on our microscope to measure the extent of invasion into the cervix to determine the most appropriate next step in treatment, which is usually deciding whether to observe after a complete excision of a small cancer or remove the rest of the uterus. Or for larger cancers that might have spread or very large cancers that are confined to the cervix, radiation and chemotherapy, as was discussed. Part of this evaluation by the pathologist and looking at the tissue is also determining the tumor type. Now, for cervical cancer, it's generally divided into human papillomavirus-associated cancers, which is, almost all of the cervical cancers, and then there are rare cancers that aren't associated with HPV in the cervix. And those HPV-related cancers come in a variety of types, including what's called squamous cell carcinoma, the most common type, adenocarcinoma, which is the second most common. Sometimes they show both features, so adenosquamous carcinoma is what we call those tumors. And then there's a tumor called small cell carcinoma, which we think about differently for treatment in general. So with the exception of small cell carcinoma, melanoma, though most of those types of cervical cancer that I mentioned are generally at this point still treated the same way regardless of subtype. So the distinction might not be critically important like it is for other cancers for cervical cancer, but I'll mention there is one type of non-HPV-associated cancer called gastric type endocervical cancer that can rarely be seen in families. So it's important to recognize those and potentially identify patients with gastric type cervical cancer that might benefit from genetic counseling for a syndrome called Peutz-Jeghers syndrome. But most of the time, cervical cancers are HPV-related. The pathologist, it's also important to make a distinction between cervical cancer and endometrial cancer. And this is actually a more common problem than you might think. So the cervix and the endometrium are very close to one another in the uterus. And it can be challenging to distinguish whether the cancer started in the cervix or in the endometrium at the time of diagnosis. And so making sure to make that distinction of cervical cancer versus endometrial cancer really has huge treatments and huge implications in terms of treatment and genetic implications of the cancer. So we try very hard to make an accurate diagnosis as to where the tumor started, and we use tools like HPV testing to help make that distinction sometimes. So this process of making a pathology diagnosis usually takes a few days, but it can take longer depending on if the tumor is unusual or rare, or if more than one pathologist has to weigh in on the case or extra tests are needed. The pathology for, say, a radical hysterectomy specimen with lymph node biopsies might take a little bit longer because it's such a complex examination of the tissue to figure out how far the cancer has spread. And these pathology reports can be very complex to read, and I encourage you to look at them and go over them in detail with your cancer team. Pathologists use very technical language in these reports that might be difficult to understand, so go over those. And it's very likely that your cancer doctors have already discussed the report in detail with the pathologist at a multidisciplinary conference or over the phone, especially if the findings are very complicated. And so I'll spend a few minutes next talking about biomarkers and molecular testing in pathology for cervical cancer. So as Dr. Einstein mentioned, for immunotherapy, the most common test that we're doing in cervical cancer patients to help choose therapy is called PD-L1. I'll say sort of how that test is used a little bit differently from a pathology perspective. So PD-L1 is a protein that's used by the tumor to hide from a patient's immune system. And without that PD-L1 being expressed, the body might otherwise recognize the cancer and fight it off like an infection. So these drugs called immune checkpoint inhibitors or immunotherapy basically block the tumor from using that protein PD-L1 to hide from the immune system. And so we look for PD-L1 under a microscope. It's actually a stain. And the staining pattern for this PD-L1 protein is interpreted by a pathologist and assigned what's called a combined positive score, or CPS, which takes into account the number of immune cells, so cells that are trying to fight off infection or tumors or other foreign things in your body, and the tumor cells. And so we combine the immune cells and the tumor cells to come up with this combined positive score that have PD-L1 protein. And it turns out that number helps us decide whether immunotherapy is more or less likely to work for you. And the cutoff for cervical cancer is a combined positive score of 1, but it's likely that higher numbers are even better, so might predict an even better response to immunotherapy. There are many other tests like next-generation sequencing that can be used to identify targets in cervical cancer beyond PD-L1, but we're sort of looking for a needle in a haystack with those biomarkers. And, for first-line therapy, we really aren't at this point using next-generation sequencing to identify targeted therapy for first-line. But for patients who have recurrent disease or progress and we're looking for another therapy for them, that next-generation sequencing test can identify changes in the DNA and proteins and fusions, like Dr. Einstein had talked about RET and NTRK as being potential biomarkers to match patients with clinical trials that have those alterations in their tumor. But they're, you know, rare alterations only seen in a small percentage of cervical cancers, and so we're really looking for a needle in a haystack there. So that concludes what I have to say about pathology and biomarkers, and I'll turn the conference back over to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Kerr. That was just a wonderful, stellar presentation. Very informative, and I think it's rather rare sometime for our participants to hear from a pathologist, so very grateful for your being on the call and being so well-spoken and also giving so much information about the role of a pathologist. So I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A, and thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Diana Bearden, and Ms. Bearden is an oncology dietitian at the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center, and Ms. Bearden will be addressing nutrition and hydration concerns and suggestions. It's my pleasure to introduce my esteemed colleague, Ms. Bearden.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. I'm glad to be part of today's presentation. So nutrition and hydration are fundamental in providing your body what it needs to do to function. The question a lot of patients have is, you know, what should I eat or what should I avoid while I'm getting cancer treatment? And the answer is there's not a perfect answer to that question. Whenever we're looking at nutrition and your healthcare plan, it's very individualized. Things like other comorbidities you have or your level of nourishment coming into the treatment are some things, just a couple of things that are considerations when we're talking about your nutrition plan. But however, in general, a whole food plant-based diet is recommended. It's where about two-thirds of your plate is covered with a plant-based food, such as a fruit, vegetable, grain, bean, pea, lentil, nuts, seeds, and the other third with a lean protein, such as a wild-caught fish, white meat from chicken or turkey, and even lean red meats. You can occasionally just do an all plant-based meal where the beans and the peas and the lentils become part of your protein. The plant-based foods provide your body with important components that help our body optimally function, such as phytochemicals, vitamins, minerals, fiber, antioxidants. The lean proteins help provide building blocks to help your body repair from an injury or some of the results from treatment. The key to a whole foods plant-based diet is looking at the food and seeing it as it was when it was harvested or as close to that form. So if you're eating something with apples in it, you want to make sure that it looks like an apple. Those are questions that I get a lot of times from patients, and nutrition really doesn't have to be complicated. It's just meeting with your healthcare team and understanding what your needs are helps individualize that plan a little bit more for you. The dietitian is part of your healthcare team, and the role of the dietitian is to help support you with individualizing your nutrition plan, helping you modify it based on any side effects you might be experiencing. And some of the side effects we see with patients are things like poor appetite, nausea, vomiting, maybe a sore mouth or a sore throat, diarrhea, fatigue. The concern is if you're not able to meet your nutrition goals, it may result in a delay in treatment or a change in your plan. So communicating with your healthcare team whenever you're struggling sooner rather than later is really key to helping make sure that you get the attention that you need as quickly as you need it. One of the things I often have conversations with patients about is my weight. People are a lot of times thinking, well, I'll lose some weight during this treatment. And during treatment is not the time to experience weight loss. The dietitian can talk with you about, you know, what your nutrition needs are. If there's a conversation where weight loss is part of that, then it's about doing it at a rate that is reasonable and appropriate to help try to maintain as much of your lean muscle mass as possible. But even if you're overweight, you can become malnourished. Weight and nourishment don't go hand in hand. So that's sometimes a misconception, especially in our society today. When your nutrition needs are not met, oftentimes the body, when you're going through treatment, that is, the body can start using some of your muscle for energy because it's very quick to break down as opposed to fat. And when we lose muscle, it's hard to get that muscle back, especially when you're going through treatment. And a loss of muscle can result in things like fatigue, a decrease in your endurance, and maybe even an increase in fall risk. So we want to really maintain that lean muscle mass. There are medications to assist with addressing the side effects that you might experience, and talk with your healthcare team. And a lot of times when you're going through treatment, there's a lot of medications that you're being introduced to. Have somebody there, have a scribe or a resource where you can be specific in when to take medications so that you don't feel overwhelmed or confused. A lot of times I meet with patients and their weight loss or their challenges are really based on their side effects. It's like getting that medication in order to help address the side effects and then going from there. Hydration is sometimes overlooked. We're so focused on getting patients to eat sometimes and maintaining weight. Hydration can be sometimes the last thing on the list until there's an issue. And dehydration is very possible. It can actually become more of an issue if you're having a lot of diarrhea or vomiting, or if you're just not eating a lot. Usually people drink when they eat. So if you're not eating as much, you're probably not drinking enough. So dehydration can actually increase some of the side effects, the feelings of some of the side effects that you may experience, such as nausea, fatigue, can even make you feel dizzy and give you a headache. A fluid is anything that's liquid at room temperature, such as water, milk, sports drinks, juice. A general guideline is most people need between 8 and 10 8-ounce glasses of fluid per day, but treatments such as radiation and sometimes just your response to treatment may require more fluid or potentially less fluid, just depending on what you're dealing with at the time. So connecting again with your healthcare team sooner rather than later can be very beneficial. In closing, you know, there are several health members of your healthcare team, and we're here for you. And so know how to reach out to us, know how to connect with us, and get with us sooner rather than later. Thanks for allowing me to be part of today's workshop. I'm going to hand the line back over to Carolyn.
Very informative. Thank you so much to Stella, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next presenter is Aisha McClellan, and she is Cervical Program Coordinator for Share Cancer Support and our partner organization on today's program. And she'll be describing for you briefly about the brief services of Share Cancer Support. It's my pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Aisha.
Hi, my name is Aisha. I am a cervical cancer survivor and the Cervical Cancer Program Coordinator at Share Cancer Support. So SHARE is a nonprofit that not only supports cervical cancer, but we also support breast cancer, metastatic breast cancer, ovarian cancer, and uterine cancer. And we support people in different ways, we facilitate support groups that are generally peer-led by other survivors. We have support groups for all of the cancer types that I mentioned, in addition to caregiver support groups. We also have a patient navigation program. We have 24-hour helplines for all of our cancer types. We often have webinars pertaining to so many different cancer-specific topics. And there's also different components of SHARE, which is AfroShare, focusing on the African American population and outreach, and Chinese Share as well. And we also have Latina Share, so a lot of the programs are also in Spanish. And I'll hand it back over to you.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. McClellan. That was a superb presentation and a wonderful resource to everybody on the call. And you'll be all receiving a SurveyMonkey evaluation at the end of the program. And we'll be giving you all the resources that our speakers have mentioned So it is an evaluation form, but it also includes all the resources that we have mentioned during the program, and we may add some additional ones as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Cassie Spector, and Cassie Spector is an oncology social worker. She's our breast and gynecological cancers program coordinator at Cancer Care, and she'll be addressing Cancer Care's free programs and services. It's my pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Spector.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. As mentioned, my name is Cassie Spector, and I'm the breast and gynecological cancers program coordinator and oncology social worker at Cancer Care. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization providing free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, counseling, support groups, educational workshops, publications, and limited financial assistance. Individuals diagnosed with cervical cancer may choose to supplement their existing social networks by joining a support group or engaging in counseling. Many hospitals, treatment centers, and nonprofit organizations offer supportive services. Being a member of a support group can offer the opportunity to speak with others who are going through a similar experience, obtain information, and gain support. Cancer Care offers a specific gynecological cancer support group. Our online support groups take place using a password-protected message board format and are led by oncology social workers. You can register for an online support group through Cancer Care's website, cancercare.org, and then selecting our services and then support groups. Individuals may also experience practical and financial concerns throughout your treatment. Please know if you're encountering such financial hardships, there are organizations that may be able to help you. Cancer Care offers resource navigation services to speak with a resource navigator who can help you find additional resources. And this is available for patients and caregivers nationally. If you're interested in learning more about the support services we offer at Cancer Care, I encourage you to call Cancer Care's National Hope Line at 800-813-4673 to speak with one of our oncology social workers. It's been a pleasure to be part of this program. I'll turn it back to Dr. Meisner.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Spector. That was a superb presentation and wonderful resources for our participants as well. So thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A. I'm going to ask Bella if she would please explain to our audience how to queue up for questions. Bella?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So this is for Dr. Einstein. Which other cancers are also related to HPV infection?
That's an excellent question. You know, HPV and papillomaviruses in general have coexisted with mammals throughout millennia. In fact, we did a study showing that we've identified papillomavirus sequences in fossils that predate dinosaurs. This virus knows how to hide from the immune system. A number of other places that this virus goes to is on what we call epithelial surfaces, or surfaces that potentially are exposed to open air. And that could not just be the cervix, but the vulva, the vagina, the anus. Also, some certain head and neck cancers are associated with HPV, or particularly that of the tonsil, and also some penile cancers, but that's far rare.
Excellent. Thank you so much. The question for Dr. Runowitz, how can having my cervix removed affect fertility?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
How can having my cervix removed affect fertility?
So it depends on how radical the procedure is. But if you go to a gynecologic oncologist who has done what's called a trachelectomy, which is removal of the cervix, they can recreate a situation where you don't have a cervix anymore, but the sperm can get up to the egg either through natural or through assisted reproductive technology. So your fertility may be decreased, but by taking only the cervix and leaving the uterus, that option is open to get pregnant.
Excellent, thank you. And a question for Dr. Einstein. Can a person who had previous chemotherapy and radiation therapy from previous breast cancer get cervical cancer?
Yes. Unfortunately, this is a different kind of cancer, a different sort of pathogenesis that comes to it. There's not a genetic linkage between breast cancer and cervical cancer. However, cervical cancer happens in anybody, but we could, you know, with primary prevention with vaccines and with secondary prevention with screening, we could prevent a large amount of cervical cancer.
Excellent. A question for Dr. Kerr. What are the genetic testing and other blood tests for identifying cervical cancer?
Yeah, so as we discussed on the call, the main genetic test that we use to identify cervical cancer is HPV testing. Now, we call it genetic, but it's really it's a molecular test looking for genetic material that HPV has, the virus itself. And that virus is shed from the precancer cancer cells. There are some cancers. I talked about Peutz-Jeghers syndrome is associated with a specific type of not HPV-associated cancer, and families with that syndrome can benefit from seeing a genetic counselor to test for the germline mutation associated with that syndrome. So I don't know if that is getting at the question, but yeah, there aren't really any genetic biomarker tests that we use at this point to detect cervical cancer other than detecting the virus itself.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Question for Dr. Einstein, how is immunotherapy being used as a treatment option for cervical cancer? When is it appropriate?
No, excellent question. We've had a number of clinical trials that have recently been released that have shown that the earlier we use immunotherapy in treatment, the better survival. So in the most recent trial is this, again, this KEYNOTE-A18 trial that showed that for locally advanced cervical cancer, so that's basically cervix cancer that remains in the pelvis but has not spread out of the pelvis, we use immunotherapy with chemotherapy and radiation therapy. And then we also use immunotherapy long after the radiation therapy for many months, at least 14 months, upwards of 24 months. In addition, Dr. Ronowitz had mentioned this earlier, in the metastatic setting or when someone has metastatic or recurrent disease, we use immunotherapy in combination with other cytotoxic therapies. So as a single agent, we generally don't use it. We use it, again, tagged with other either cytotoxics or even targeted therapies.
And another question for Dr. Einstein. How much medical attention will an undocumented person with cervical cancer receive?
Most places like ours, we don't collect that information from patients. In terms of our rules here, it's a HIPAA violation for anyone to ask us this type of stuff with regards to patients, but we don't even know it because we don't collect that information, and most health systems don't.
So a collective sigh of relief to hear that. Thank you so much. And now I'm going to ask our speakers if they could provide a takeaway from today's program. I'll start with Dr. Einstein.
Well, first and foremost, thank you all so much for your learning and education and being able to share this knowledge with others. And as much as I could educate and spread the word about the innovations that we have, the better, because, we can work together to have less people suffer from cervical cancer. I think the good thing that you all should know is that there's a tremendous amount of new therapies for cervical cancer that are available to us that we just did not have even 5 years ago. And a lot of that is through clinical trials. So I do want to encourage that, in most clinical trials, people are getting the standard of care and then usually the kicker as well. And this is the kind of thing that we want to encourage so that we can have more treatments for tomorrow and better treatments for tomorrow so we could really achieve overall cure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Dr. Runowitz, your takeaway?
I'd also like to thank you for inviting me and for the attention of this worldwide audience listening. And I think the information that you've heard today is really very current, and hopefully it applies to all of you. I'd just like to add a couple of things. Many cities and states have what we call safety net hospitals. Here in Miami, for example, in the city, we have hospitals that take all patients unrelated to insurance or citizenship status, and then we work closely with the social workers in trying to figure out how best to treat these patients and to get them into clinical trials. I know these are challenging times, and I know that some of the immigrants are very nervous about therapy, but I want to emphasize that with cervical cancer, delay is a disaster. The treatment in an early stage is can be up to almost 100%. Waiting till it gets to advanced stage becomes much more challenging and much more challenging treatment. There are many, many developments, many, many clinical trials, so I urge all of you to access the cancer clinical trials, access these programs that take all comers regardless of insurance. And thank you for including me in this very informative teleconference.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Runowitz. And Dr. Kerr?
Yeah, I always tell patients, keep track of your pathology reports, because unfortunately with cervical cancer, especially if it's caught at an early stage, your treatment is likely to be very successful and you'll have a long survival. But patients as they live longer can get new cancers or new lesions. And so when I'm looking at, say, a lung biopsy from someone who has a history of some sort of cancer of the uterus, I really need to know what that was. And so if you've moved between health systems, I might not have access to that pathology report. And so I really recommend keeping track of those reports so that, if your pathologist needs to know your records, decades down the line, we'll know what that was. And it just helps us so much to make an accurate diagnosis for, using less resources if we know that information. So keep track of your pathology reports.
Thank you so much. That's so important, Dr. Kerr, really important. Ms. Burden?
I would say know your healthcare team and know who to access for different needs, social work, dietitian, pharmacist, like have an idea of who's on your team so they can be accessed by you, get their business cards, how to communicate with them so you don't have to wait until a visit necessarily to get some help and get some intervention. So I would say know your healthcare team, reach out to them sooner rather than later, and communicate your needs so that you can get the help that you need.
Excellent. And Aisha Ms. McClellan, your takeaway?
I would just say just know that there is support out there and you're not alone, and there's always someone out there that is willing and able to help and be your best advocate, and always reach out for help when you need it.
Thank you so much. And Ms. Spector?
Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to be part of this program. And I would just echo the other speakers' sentiments of really just reaching out for support when you need it. Know there's organizations like Cancer Care and Share and your treatment team that are there to support you. So really find who you feel comfortable with on your treatment team to be able to direct you to the support that you're looking for.
Excellent. I just want to thank all of our speakers. You've been phenomenal. I want to thank our participants for asking such great questions. And I do want to comment about the questions. We weren't able to take everyone's question, so we took some of the questions, but not everyone's question. So I'd like to remind all of you that for those of you who asked a question, you learned a lot from today's program. So we want you to go back to your treating healthcare team and ask your questions of your healthcare team. Again, with the information you've learned today, And for those of you who didn't get to ask a question, take your question to your healthcare team. Remember, they know you the best. They have your medical records. They have everything about you. So it's really important to take what you've learned today and ask your question of your healthcare team. It'll definitely be a more informed question, and again, you've learned a lot, so you have a lot to contribute asking your question. And also, I just want to comment that for many of our participants on the program today, and all of our programs, you often can reach your healthcare team during the day, but it's evenings, weekends, and holidays that people have the most difficulty reaching their healthcare team. So I would recommend that all of you, each and every one of you, ask your healthcare team who you can contact evenings, weekends, and holidays. That's really important. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.